You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to a podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiation Science and the Development of the Human Mind, Collected Works, Volume 228, translated by Anna Moise. This is Lecture 7 of 8 lectures, given in Stuttgart on the 15th of September, 1923. Yesterday my aim was to show the state of mind or soul which people living in a particular region had at an earlier time by considering the evolution of Druid culture, which is close to our anthroposophical movement at the present time. Going back through 3, 4, 5,000 years in human evolution, it is different for different regions around the globe. We can always enter into such states of mind which were very different. Being states of mind, they do, of course, mean that the whole cultural and social direction and guidance of human life is in accord with the conditions for such a state of mind or soul at a given time. The evolution to which I am referring relates to the gradual unfolding of conscious awareness. People were very different in earlier times compared to today, and will be different again in future times. Conventional history has little to say about this. Because of this, going beyond a few centuries from the historical present, ordinary history largely proves to be illusionary by nature, if one seeks real human understanding. Yesterday, I said that essentially we will have to observe three states of conscious awareness, inevitably again with many nuances: waking, dreaming, and sleeping. Our present-day levels of consciousness, yes, that truly is the present time, admittedly a present time which continues for centuries, and indeed millennia, but historically speaking, makes up the present. Going back to earlier times in human evolution, we do not find the waking state with logical sequences of ideas, to which I referred yesterday. The further we go back to begin with through human evolution, the more do we not find that kind of logical mind. This really only came up in all severity in the 14th and 15th centuries, its first beginnings having been in the later years of ancient Greek civilization. We do, however, find a much more lively state of mind in earlier times, filled with images and not ideas. And we find this in the whole of humanity. The natural forces we know today were quite unknown in that form to the people of those earlier times. At the time of which I spoke yesterday, people would not speak of the laws of meteorology governing winds and weather. As I said, they would speak of something that had image nature, of elemental spirits active in the plant world, of giants, spirits active in the winds, the weather, frost and hail, gales and thunder, and so on. Everything seen in nature was alive then. They did not draw logical conclusions. They looked at all the life, activity, billowing and welling forth of spirits in objects and also in the natural phenomena, the elements. The foundation for inner states of soul was entirely different for those earlier people from what it is today. This state of soul was such that people were really much more contained within themselves than we are today. But this inner containment was, again, different from anything we know today. It was at the same time a state of mind that moved in dream images, yet extended out into cosmic space. They would see images, but they did not see them in the way in which we have a thought today, and the objects are there outside. No, the giants of which they were sentient, frost giants, storm giants, fire giants, and the spirits of which they were sentient in root, leaf, and flower, In all these they felt connected with the plant, with roots, leaves, flowers, with the lightning, with the thunder. They did not feel themselves to be separate from outside nature in their inner life, for they lived in the Spirit, in images of Spirit, in their souls. It is not exactly in the very earliest times, of which I wrote in my title Occult Science and Outline, also known as an Outline of Esoteric Science, but in the times which followed, that spiritual investigation shows how that state of mind evoked a quite specific inner mood in the important nations of those times. There certainly was a time when people would still inwardly perceive much of what truly is essential human nature. In the images I have just mentioned, they saw not merely their current existence, but also their life before they came to earth. They looked into a perspective in time the way we today look into a perspective in space. This was not memory, but vision. They looked beyond their birth into a spiritual world from which they had come down into human life on earth. It was natural for these earlier people to look at this pre-earthly existence and be sentient. Quote, "As a human being, I am a spirit. For before I assumed an earthly body, I was in the keeping of spirituality, having my existence there, living my human destiny, not yet in a physical body, but in," close quote, if I may put it like this, in spite of it being paradoxical, continue quote, "a spiritual bodily nature," close quote. They would have felt it to be utterly absurd to be asked to believe in the Spirit, just as we would find it absurd to believe in mountains, for we see the mountains. At that time, they would see pre-birth life, though in an inward way, in soul vision. Then came a time when people did see this inwardly human aspect in the Spirit, seeing it as the events in pre-birth existence. But nature itself, the nature outside in their surroundings, was becoming more and more of a kind of riddle. I would say that pure sensory observation was gradually moving to the fore in human evolution. In very early times, the times of ancient Indian civilization, which I described in my title Occult Science and Outline, human beings still saw absolutely everything in the Spirit, including the natural world. A step forward came when vision in the Spirit remained inward, and nature gradually began, if I may put it like this, to be dispirited. People felt inwardly that they were spirit of spirit, and they looked out on the flora in flower, on the cloud propelling the lightning from itself, on the winds and the weather, on the delicate or marvelously shaped crystals, on hill and vale, on all those things. A certain mood then arose which one can trace through long periods of time in spiritual investigation. It came particularly on what was then civilized humanity, a mood which may be said to have been more or less as follows. Quote, "We are spirit of spirit. In pre-earthly existence, we human beings were connected with spirituality. Now we have been placed in a natural environment. We see the beautiful flowers, the huge mountains, nature mightily active in the winds and the weather. But there is no longer spiritual. But that is no longer spiritual." Close quote. The idea of mere nature around one was progressively coming to the fore. Now, however, the human being, I am, of course, speaking of the advanced human being, someone whom we might call civilized in the terms of that time, felt that his living body was created from the substances, the physical matter of this natural world, which was without spirit, without gods. If something like this were to come to modern people, the people of today, they would speculate, philosophize, and reflect on this. That was not the case, at least initially, with the people of an earlier time. They would not reflect, but be sentient of a tremendous disharmony in their inner experiences. Quote, I am spirit from spirit land. My true human nature comes from divine heights. But I am clothed in something which has been taken from a natural world that seems to be without spirit. My spiritual existence is interwoven with something which does not show me the spirit. My body is of the same substance as the plants flowering in the fields, of the same substance as the water from the clouds and pouring rain. This substance is, however, devoid of gods. Close quote. And it would feel to them like being cast out from the spiritual world, cast out into a world to which they did not really belong. One might reject this mood, sleep through it, which happens with very many moods in our present civilization. But the people who were awake at that time in the past were sentient of it, and humanity develops in moods, in things we feel and not in ideas and thoughts. Even the development of thoughts in our time is but an episodic development, as we shall see in these very lectures. And someone who merely talks in thoughts is really talking in unreality. The very way in which people talk today is a talking in unreality. People who consider themselves to be most practical, downright bursting with arrogance over their practical nature, are essentially the greatest theoreticians. Today, theoreticians are sitting in their offices and, of course, also occupying university chairs. And in that case, I would say it is a matter of course. But they are also sitting in their offices and move around in the world of trade. Everything is set up theoretically, everything caught up in thoughts. That is one episode. Initially, there is no truth to it. It will only come to be true when these people are going to be sentient about this life in thoughts and feel about it the way human beings did in the past, when nature seemed to them to be devoid of spirit. Quote, we are cast out, a race that has been cast out. We are outside of the divine and spiritual heights, where we really belong, have been placed in a world where, as human beings, we do not belong. Close quote. One outcome of this mood is something which then came up as a reflection, a revelation of this mood, the notion of the fall into sin. That idea came from a change in conscious awareness. People said to themselves, quote, we have been cast out of the spiritual world. That must be because of original sin. Close quote. At a particular period, the notion of original sin, of the fall of humanity, lived dimly in human minds. We understand this notion of an original sin, a sin committed before time, a fall before time. If we understand how humanity's conscious awareness changed from past to present and future. What people needed when that mood came over them during that period was not a dull theory. It was, above all, something which could be put in words, in such a way that the words could be balm for souls in need of comfort. We then see something we have often referred to as the guidance given to people in the ancient places of rites and religion, in the mysteries, come up again during a period that is approximately the same as the ancient Persian, the ancient Chaldean civilization in the Near East. We see how this came together with the quality which the priests in the mysteries developed, and which made them the greatest comforters of humanity. They became comforters. Comfort shone out from the mysteries. For comfort was needed, considering how conscious awareness developed at that time. There had to be a soul quality in the words that came to people's hearts, and was like a balm, a comforting balm. It was an age which, with regard to creativity and religion and the arts, was one of magnificent creative power, though in one respect it was different from what it became later. Many of the details in our art, our religious ideas, do still come from that time. And it is, above all, ritual symbols, ritual images and acts, which still go back to those ancient times. What did those teachers in the mysteries, who had to provide comfort, draw on? Well, although general waking consciousness consisted in an awareness in images that were very much alive, as I have described it, there were, nevertheless, three levels of conscious awareness at that time. Where we have sleeping, dreaming, and the waking state today, sleep did then not differ from the waking dream state, which was the general waking state, as I mentioned yesterday. Sleep, as it is carried out in the general state of awareness we have today, fully paralyzes our conscious awareness. For those earlier people, conscious awareness was very dim during sleep, but something did remain behind when they woke up. The way I put it yesterday was that they had an inner aftertaste of sleep on awakening. Most of them felt a certain sweetness of things lived through that would fill the whole of them, not only on the tongue or palate, but like an aftertaste. The sweetness of life in sleep spread also into their life during the day. This sweetness marked a healthy state of life to them. When other tastes got mixed in, this would be a sign of sickness. It sounds paradoxical when we say today that in earlier times, human beings sensed the sweet after effect of sleep in their limbs, in their arms, and down to the fingertips, in the other parts of their organism. But that is how it was. Spiritual science reveals it. Our language still bears witness to it, though it has become materialistic and less subtle. A sleeping draught was something spiritual in the past. It was sleep itself. It only became something material later on, a fluid which one would be drinking. Sleep itself was a draught from nature, a draught that made the ordinary daytime memory fade away. It was at the same time a draught to make you forget. Ordinary people had a vague after-sensation, but initiation gave the teachers in the mysteries, leaders of the people, a more accurate awareness of what human beings actually lived through in their sleep. Today, modern initiation takes us from developing ordinary ideas to spirit vision. The people of those earlier times would step down, as it were, from dreamlike waking into the sleep state, but they acquired conscious awareness for it. So that an ordinary person would have the aftertaste, and the mystery priest would, in a conscious way, feel his way into, grow sentient of sleep itself, and, as it were, got to know the principle that would then produce the aftertaste, as I have described it. He got to know the waters beyond physical existence, the waters into which the human soul entered in sleep, the waters into which the soul entered, the waters it is immersed in every night. These were the waters of the nature and activity of the astral world. Compared to waking dreams, this, however, was merely the second state or condition. The third state was one of which present-day humanity does not know anything at all, a state deeper than the dreamless sleep of today. Yesterday I said we should call it being embraced by the earth. Every human being was in that state in the middle of the night's deep sleep. But only the mystery priest, being initiated, was able to have conscious awareness of what one found there, was able to convey the results of this conscious awareness, and that was the science of that day. People would then not merely say, quote, "I am embraced by the earth," close quote, Yes, they would say that as well, but they also said something else. Yes, they would say to themselves, quote, I am embraced by the earth, close quote, but be sentient of something, as if in the everyday course of life they had entered into a state that was really already very close to death, but a death from which one would awaken again. In this state of conscious awareness, they would feel as if they had really gone down into the earth, as if they had already been put into a grave, though this would not be an earthly grave. This grave was not merely produced as an idea, but had to be produced as an idea. And I can illustrate this for you in the following way. Let me read that again. This grave was not merely produced as an idea, but had to be produced as an idea. And I can illustrate this for you in the following way. You see, the sun's rays do not merely come down to earth and give luster to the flowers, shine out from the stars. A farmer is more aware of this than a city person, for he also makes use of the way the sun's heat entered into the earth in winter. The heat which has streamed into the earth in the summer is there in the soil then. And not only the heat, other powers of the sun also stream into the earth. But from the point of view from which I am now speaking, this was actually less important. The more important thing was that the moon influences could also penetrate the earth, going down below the surface of the earth, as it were. I would say that it was a beautiful idea in those old days, not just poetic, but hyper-poetic, that people had an image, not just a logical view, but an image of how silvery sunlight streamed down in the light of the full moon and then entered right into the earth. An image of this moon silver penetrating a certain distance into the soil and then shining back again from the inner earth, having been taken in by the earth and not from the surface. People felt that the way the silvery moon billowed and welled, shining in and shining out, flowing in and out in billows, this was not just a beautiful image. As a mystery priest, one would know something quite specific about this billowing, welling moonlight. They knew that human beings are subject to gravity on earth. Gravity, gravitation keeps them grounded. And in a way, the earth keeps its creatures close to it with gravity. The priest knew that the moon powers counteracted gravity. It is just that they are generally weaker than the more robust gravity of earth. But it is they which counteract the forces of gravity on earth. They knew this. They knew that human beings were not just a lump held fast by earth's gravity, but that they were in a kind of equilibrium, attracted by the earth, drawn away by the moon, though earth's gravity had the upper hand for human beings on earth. However, this negative gravity, I'd say this gravity which drew away, did take effect for the element that was active in the human head. Although it did not enable one to fly, one could elevate one's spirit to the starry heavens. With this initiation, by the roundabout route via the moon's influences, the mystery priests of that time helped people to know the influences that the surrounding stars have on human beings on earth. That was the astrological initiation, which is so much misused today. It was particularly marked among the Chaldeans. In this roundabout way, they knew something not only about the moon's influences, but also about the influences of the sun, of Mars, Saturn, and so on. Today, man has become, forgive me for presenting this too in the form of an image, but such things are difficult to characterize logically, man is an earthworm today, where knowledge is concerned. No, not even an earthworm, something worse. Man has turned into an earthworm for which there is never any rain, which never emerges from the soil. Earthworms emerge from the soil at certain times, when it is raining, and they then have a part in what goes on above ground, which is of benefit to them. Today man is an earthworm in soul and spirit, for which there is never any rain. He is completely encapsulated where the earthly sphere is concerned. He'll think, for instance, quote, "The parts of my body simply grow in about the same way as stones also develop on earth." Close quote. Modern people do not know, of course, that their hair, the hairs on their head, results from sun influences, and so forth, that they are earthworms for which there is never any rain, bearing the sun influences within them, but never coming up to the surface to investigate anything of this kind. The priests at the ancient mysteries knew very well that man has not grown from the soil like a head of cabbage, but has come into being thanks to the concerted efforts of the whole starry cosmos around him. So you see how in the past people related to their initiated guides in the mysteries, who had been initiated in the way I have shown, and knew what the cosmic surroundings of the earth had to signify for human beings. This made it possible for the priests to tell something to people, which I am going to put in fairly commonplace words, for today we are not as yet in a position to speak in the way of those priests in the ancient mysteries, who would also put things in marvelous poetic form. This was possible with the genius of language at that time. Today we cannot speak like that, for our language does not make it possible. Today we might put the things the priests in the mystery said to the people who looked to them for comfort in a natural world without spirit, into which they felt they had been banished, in the following words. Quote, "Yes, for as long as you are in life, in the states of ordinary waking consciousness, your environment will seem to you to be without spirit." Close quote. However, if we enter consciously into the regions around the world where we see the gods of the stars active in the light of the silvery moon, which flows and billows to the earth, if we can do that, we learn to see no longer of its own accord, which was the case in earlier times, but through human effort, that spirits are after all present everywhere in this outside natural world, a nature which bears within it gifts of the gods, spirits, elemental spirits. I'm going to read that sentence again. However, if we enter consciously into the regions around the world, where we see the gods of the stars active in the light of the silvery moon, which flows and billows to the earth, if we can do that, we learn to see, no longer of its own accord, which was the case in earlier times, but through human effort, that spirits are, after all, present everywhere in this outside natural world, a nature which bears within it gifts of the gods, spirits, elemental spirits. And so, the comfort which the priests in the mysteries would give to people in those ancient times was that they made them aware that plants are not just beautiful, they are truly also filled with spiritual activity and spiritual beings, that the clouds do not just move majestically through the air, but that divine elemental spirits are active in them, and so on. As initiates, the priests guided those whom they had to guide to the spirit in nature. At a particular stage of human evolution, it was the function of the mysteries to tell people, quote, "It is merely an illusion, part of waking dream life, that nature is without spirit. In reality, spirit may be found everywhere in the natural world." Close quote. So there was once a human past when human beings actually lived within the spirituality of existence in this way, and thanks to the institution of the mysteries, learned of the spirituality of existence also in the sphere that initially seemed to them to be devoid of spirit. Everything which thus came to human beings, be it from instinct, for instance, vision of the inner spirituality, or from being taught in the mysteries, for instance, that the spirit is all present in nature, did after all make them dependent on spirituality. If things had continued like this in human evolution, something which today we have to admit is one of the greatest privileges, perhaps even the central privilege for humanity, could never have come to conscious awareness, and that is sentience of free will, the sense of freedom. The state of mind where spirituality was sensed instinctively had to fade away. Humanity had to be taken to other states of mind. That sense of being embraced by the earth, which gave the ancient initiates the power to draw on star wisdom, and hence the spirituality of nature, fell into complete decay. Only dreamless sleep, dreaming and the waking state, remained for the human soul. We might say that the region of mind in which freedom would be able to dawn was added at the other end, the wide-awake state of mind in which we have our everyday life and pursuit of knowledge today, was something totally unknown to an earlier humanity. But this was where the possibility arose for pure thought, the existence of which may make us despair, but from which alone we can gain the impulses for freedom. If humanity had never gained this faculty of pure thought, which does not at the same time establish existence, but is pure thought, neither would we ever have gained awareness of freedom. I'd like to say that the connection of man with spirituality, which had existed, lay in darkness behind human evolution. Instead, human beings gained these three states of conscious awareness, and these actually took them from spiritual heights down into depths of earth. But they were meant to find their very own power to develop freedom from those very depths. Essentially, the dawn of this state of soul, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, had already been there for 1,000 years. Humanity had moved a long way into a particular darkness, the darkness in which the impulse for freedom lies, but the light of spirituality does not shine. Do develop a real feeling for the way this really was in human evolution. Looking back into an early age, we see human beings looking up into the starry heavens, and out of the knowledge they had of those starry heavens, saying to themselves, quote, "The powers of those starry heavens live in me. I am part of this cosmos." Close quote. As a spirit, man had been forced down to earth. The heavens had grown dark, so to say, for human beings were not able to see through, to understand the light, even sunlight or the light of the stars, all that shone down in a physical way. It was as if a curtain had come down, and human beings could not find support in any way for their existence. They could no longer see anything that was behind the curtain. Tomorrow we shall see that this curtain had actually been there for 1,000 years, how it grew denser and denser, and how this destiny of the curtain was reflected in the whole mood of humanity. Then a light came through the curtain, and the curtain fell apart, as it were. This was the light that arose on Golgotha. The event on Golgotha entered into human evolution. In this event, an event that happened on earth, human beings were to see again what they had once seen in the vastness of the cosmos as the spirituality of the world. In going through the mystery on Golgotha, the Christ was to bring something which, in earlier times, had been seen in the heavens, into life on earth. The divine spirit, the Christ, was to descend and dwell in a human body, to bring this light in a new and different way to a humanity which was then unable to come away from the earth. As human beings, we are today only beginning to understand this mystery on Golgotha, and the future of earth evolution will have to consist in this mystery on Golgotha being understood by humanity with ever greater maturity, and that the glory coming from the mystery on Golgotha would be understood more and more, with inner glory becoming cosmic glory, and beginning to shine out over everything that human beings are able to look into. Before we can consider this, we need to add some further building blocks today. In a certain respect, things that have once been alive in humanity's evolution on Earth will also come back again. As I have told you, the priests in the mysteries were alive to this way of looking into the moon influences. Those moon influences took them up into their astrological initiation. They learned how it was possible to be initiated into the star secrets of the cosmos through the moon influences. An important aspect of this initiation was that something would come over the individual who was to be initiated, as if he suddenly felt within himself that gravity, weight, had less significance for him than usually. He was less aware of his weight. His teachers, who were older, told him not to give in to this, but to make a great effort of will when he felt himself to grow lighter, as it were, and give himself weight. That was, in a way, part of the craft learned in the old initiations, that one let natural weight, which had been lost under the influence of the moon, flow back into oneself again by effort of will. And with that, the star wisdom would shine out. That is how all the potential a human being had at that time to overcome gravity was used to develop the will in him to hold fast to the earth in his soul. Holding on to the earth in one's soul was like lighting an inner light in the soul to shine out into the vast cosmos. Man then became familiar with that vast cosmos. When spiritual science casts a light on these things, one can give an exact description of how this ancient state of mind arose. But this principle, which existed in those human beings, does not recur. There is such a thing as atavism, with ancient faculties being transmitted. It comes back again, for human beings do, after all, also come back again. When the connection with the powers of the moon comes up again in people who live in a later age, where it really should no longer exist, since that deep sleep no longer exists, it becomes somnambulism, especially the ordinary kind of lunatism or sleepwalking. These people do not fight the getting lighter, but walk about on roofs or at least leave their beds. They are doing something with their essential human nature which really only the astral body should do. Something which at such a later time may be said to be abnormal had in earlier times been a special asset which could be used to gain insight. The popular term, quote, moonsick, close quote, for such people made good sense, for this condition is connected with an atavistic relationship with the moon powers, which has persisted from ancient times. Human beings are thus related to the powers of the moon, as I have described. They are just as much related to the powers of the sun. It is merely that this relationship with the powers of the sun is active in a hidden way, and one only comes to it in a most indirect way. Undoubtedly, it was the Druid priests of the flowering, and not the period of decay, who looked for their sun initiation in that relationship with the powers of the sun. That sun initiation led to a condition where one was looking up, not only stimulated, in a way, by the powers of the moon, to gain some knowledge of the secrets of the cosmos in the astrological initiation. No, this sun initiation did already provide some kind of dialogue with the divine spirits in the universe, a kind of inspiration, whereas the moon initiation provided only a kind of vision in images. Sun initiation meant that one would, in a way, hear the advice of the spirits. Above all, one's eyes are now made to receive the physical rays of the sun. I mentioned yesterday that qualities of spirit and soul are present in these physical sun rays. It is just that modern people do not see this. Their attitude to the sun is like the attitude of one person meeting another, with that other individual claiming to have an inner soul, and the first individual saying to the second, quote, "No such thing as soul. When you move an arm, it is a matter of leverage, with strings, your muscles. When they are contracted, the lever is drawn up. It is a mechanism." Close quote. That is the modern-day attitude to the influence of the sun. People see only the external and physical, in this case merely physical light. Yet the spirituality of sun nature enters into us at the same time as the physical light does. With a particular kind of inner concentration, not the one I described in my title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, but one that is like an elemental force due to atavism, human beings can today, with, in quotes, today, I mean the historical period of time, which may, of course, continue for centuries, cease to be highly receptive to the physical influence of the sun, and instead grow receptive to spiritual sun nature. They then see things in a different way. Where this atavistic element appears, one sees things differently from the way one does in ordinary life today. When you look in a mirror, the mirror reflects what is in front of it. When someone has the constitution of soul, where in spite of being fully sensible, he does not look into the sun, does not see the physical light of the sun, but sees absolute darkness, then this darkness becomes a mirror and reflects his immediate surroundings, the natural world. He will then not say, quote, "This is a plant, it has a root, it produces leaves, its flower, fruit, and seed," close quote. He will say, quote, "In the lower part of the plant I see elemental spirituality of wisdom, and this has a quality of preservation, of consolidation. Further up the plant, I see this quality of preservation, of consolidation, being overcome, with the plant seeking not to consolidate, but to alternate between consolidation and dissolution in leaf development. And, finally, I see the plant strive upward, and it is like a cooking process due to the action of fire." Close quote. The life of the plant is then mirrored in the darkness, which spiritually, however, is light, similar to the way in which Jacob Boehme saw the plant atavistically, seeing salt nature below, mercurial nature in the middle, and phosphorus nature up above. We see the quality which in early times was part of human civilization, original civilization, when one was not yet able to read and write, influencing a mind such as that of Jacob Boehme, who was a natural sun initiate. If one is not able to read a work such as his titled Mysterium Magnum, De Signatura Rerum, Aurora, the Day Spring, and so forth, in such a way, as it were, that his halting words tell one something very similar to the things I have been telling you about the Druid priests, then one is reading Jacob Boehme the wrong way. He had been initiated in an outward way, but something like the recapitulation of an earlier existence on earth welled up in his inmost being, and that was this sun initiation. You can trace this even in his biography. Even more profound powers that may influence human beings come from what initially was the outermost planet in our planetary system. It is not the outermost one in modern astronomy, for two more have been added, which are some matter of concern even in modern physical astronomy, because the laws governing the movements of their moons are not quite right, and so on. They are included, however, because position in space is considered most important, and since Uranus and Neptune have joined as well, people do include them. But, as I said, They are something of a pain, because their moons have, quote, gone off course, close quote, relative to what the other, in quotes, decent moons of Jupiter and so on are doing. In real terms, we may, after all, say that for a living, concrete understanding of the planetary system, Saturn definitely is the outermost planet. Human beings can be under the influence of the moon, which I have described in more detail, or the influence of the sun, which I outline briefly. They can also be under the influence of these Saturn actions. In its spiritual emanation into the planetary system, and hence into human beings, Saturn is a kind of cosmic historic memory. It is like the memory, the remembering process in our planetary system. And if we want to know anything about what is going on in the planetary system, astronomical speculation certainly will not tell us. Today these things are beginning to make people working in external science desperate, for nothing is really quite right. But they are setting about it all in the wrong way. You see, among ourselves, we too have often spoken of the theory of relativity, as it is called, saying that one can never really speak of absolute movement in the physical world, but must always refer to relative movement. Just as one may say, quote, the sun is moving, the earth is standing still, close quote, so did people later come to say, quote, the earth is moving and the sun is standing still, close quote. All of it is merely relative, and one can say the one thing or the other. At a conference of the Anthroposophical Movement, held here in Stuttgart, people were one day speaking of the theory of relativity. A follower of this theory showed the audience in a very simple way that it does not matter if you take a match and move it along a matchbox, which you are holding, or if you hold the match still and move the box. This will also ignite it. This was a serious scientific subject, presented in all seriousness, and one cannot really say anything against it. There might have been a naive individual who might have nailed the matchbox to something, and then there would have been something absolute in it. Or perhaps one could have pushed back the whole house, Landhausstrasse 70 it was at the time, that would have restored relativity, though it would have been a bit difficult. But if we extend it to the whole physical universe, we could agree with Einstein and say, quote, nothing absolute is to be found in the physical world. Everything is definitely relative there, close quote. But people stop at relativity. It is exactly the relativity of the physical world which must make us realize that the absolute must not be sought in the physical, but in the spiritual world. Science is everywhere providing access to the spiritual world, but it has to be rightly understood. No need today to be an amateur. You can be an exact, genuine scientist, and true science will take you to the spirit. It is just that it is not thought all the way through, not even by its leading experts. Because of it, nothing can also be said in physical studies about something like the Saturn of our universe. Saturn is the remembrance, the memory of our planetary system, as it were. Everything that has happened in the planetary system is archived in it. The connection with the moon may come up one-sidedly in a person, like something inherited from earlier human evolution, something passed down from past humanity. And the person then becomes a sleepwalker, and the spiritual influences of the sun may come up again, and the individual is then actually looking into absolute darkness with open eyes, and not in the usual way, into the light, a darkness in which nature is mirrored, so that the individual sees things as Jacob Burma did. In the same way, one can also enter into relationship with the Saturn influences, which affects mainly the human head, actually implanting the passing memory during earthly life in the human being. These Saturn influences are particularly likely to show themselves. We may thus speak of moon people, the ordinary sleepwalkers, and of sun people such as Jacob Burma, even Paracelsus, though to a lesser degree. We may also speak of Saturn people. Swedenborg was a Saturn individual. He was another one who should make the usual kind of scholars rack their brains. For in ordinary science, Swedenborg truly was an authority at the height of his time. Until he reached his 40s, he was also reasonably acceptable in this science of ours, saying nothing but things that external science was able to go along with. Then, however, Swedenborg was gradually befogged. We have to say that Saturn powers grew particularly active in him. People who base themselves on materialism say that he went mad. But it should really be something to make us think that so many works by him, posthumously published by a Swedish society, are considered to be scientific. Important Swedish scholars are now involved in publishing them. These are, however, the works that he wrote before he had his spiritual vision, as we'll call it now, for now. It is difficult to speak of someone who has, as it were, the most intelligent individual in his time. Let me read that again. It is difficult to speak of someone who was, as it were, the most intelligent individual in his time until he came into his 40s, and with regard to whom one really has to say in later years, quote, he's a fool, to put it mildly, close quote. Swedenborg absolutely did not grow more stupid, but there was a particular moment, just when he had risen to the pinnacle of the ordinary science of his time, when he began to see into the spiritual world. As this took hold of his head, the organ, as it were, which he truly had developed quite specifically, he was able to look in his own way, not the way in which Jacob Burma saw the inner secrets of nature mirrored in the darkness, into the immediate ether, there where the images of higher spirituality appear in the ether. He described this spiritual world very much in his own way. His vision was not as he had imagined. The spirits to which he refers are different. Yet he did not just see these spirits mirrored by the earth, but he saw their influences in the ether. He saw ether configurations. Those were the acts of the spirit, which did not become visible themselves, in the earth's ether. Jacob Burma saw nature mirrored. Swedenborg saw what the spirits brought about in the ether, spirits of which he saw only the influences they had. So, when Swedenborg describes angels, these are not angels, but configurations in the ether. These were, however, brought about by angels, a reflection of what the angel does. It is always important to consider the reality of such things. It is wrong, of course, to say that Swedenborg saw the spiritual world as such, for he did not have that power. But he did see something that was real. The ordinary sleepwalker, the moon-sick individual, does something real. He does with his physical body what he should only be doing with his astral body. Jacob Burma first saw in such a way with his physical body, above all with the arrangement of his eyes, that he excluded the physical, looking into darkness, but saw the light in the darkness, mirroring the nature spirits. Swedenborg did not see mirror images, but the ether images of a higher spiritual existence. So there are stages from the unseeing, automatic state of being filled with the spirit of the sleepwalker, to what I'd call the natural second sight of Jacob Burma, who did not see the outer aspect of nature, but the reflection of the inner aspect, and all the way up to Swedenborg, who saw not mirror images, but reality in the ether. The images, not mirror images, of the activities or proceedings up above, in the higher spiritual region. We see, therefore, that we may speak of a human past and present, with a past still to be found in the present, with definite signs, like a legacy, taking the form of abnormal states which need to be understood. If we are thus able to look at the past and at the things which still project from the past into the present, then with the help of a thorough understanding of the mystery on Golgotha, we can also refer to a feeling for what the future will be. This will be in tomorrow's lecture. The end of Lecture 7.